Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox has details about an event to match students with agricultural careers in our area, and he'll talk to an expert about potential virtual solutions to the nursing shortage. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Ohio is an agricultural state with approximately 13.7 million acres of farmland. Much of that land is right here in central Ohio. Spring Green Career Week is March 3rd through the 7th. Now, a green career can be any job, role, or occupation that contributes to preserving or restoring the environment and our planet. Jasmine Albaran is the executive director of Seed Your Future and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having us to share a little bit about our work and Green Career Week.
So, we are happy to have you, but curious, why are horticultural jobs so vital to Central Ohio and Ohio lives?
Absolutely. And something that I remind people all the time that we kind of take for granted is that we all have to eat and we all have to breathe. And that's thanks to plants, right? And all of those careers that are helping bring those plants to us. So they are absolutely vital. These plant science jobs are the business of managing and using what we grow while maintaining the health of our soil, our air, our water, the well-being of our children and our communities, and really all around the world as well. They make a difference to virtually everything that we do and we touch. And so they're very important to all of us.
Green Career Week started in 2022 and to date has reached over 15,000 students, connecting them with over 500 companies. What kind of companies?
Any kind of horticulture, ag, floriculture job company that is in the local community, that business that is doing all they can to, again, bring these plants to us, but most people don't realize who they are. In Ohio, for example, we've had Green Circle Growers, Express Seed Company, Smithers Oasis, Willoway Nurseries, and including the Ohio State University, who have all participated in Green Career Week, opening their doors to students with tours with the eye of an employer. Right? We want these students to understand what are the jobs at these companies, how do you acquire them, do you have internships, so that students, as they're passing up these businesses, they can start thinking of themselves as an employee at these locations. Most students, when they pass up a farm, okay, I can see them growing stuff, but that's a part of what they're doing, right? There's so many logistics in getting the produce in to us. So we just want students to be aware of all of the wonderful careers in this industry, along with teachers and parents.
Do you have to have a college degree to participate, or can you do it right out of high school?
You can do it right out of high school. A lot of nurseries and greenhouses will hire. Because horticulture, and even though people don't realize it, is very science-heavy, a horticulture degree is required for most jobs, but there are some entry-level that you can take and then grow within the business and then later go back and get a degree if you like. And there are certifications. There are two-year associate degrees and then the different bachelor's, master's, and PhDs.
Now, you had mentioned the collegiate programs associated. And in north central Ohio, in Mansfield, the OSU Mansfield campus has acres of maple trees, and they study the process of extracting sap and making that into syrup. And then they partner with the folks that run the sugar houses in nearby communities. Is that part of something like this?
Absolutely, right? It's just talking about the jobs that are planting those trees, the scientists that are doing that evaluation, then you have onto that supply chain of what is being used that sap for, right? That's creating other jobs. And so, absolutely, we were talking about any career that is growing the plants, marketing the plants, transporting the plants, we want students to be aware of, that really no matter what their passion is, they're likely to find a position, a career, a fulfilling job within the horticulture industry.
And there are a lot of students that are currently enrolled in technical schools that are pursuing agricultural or horticultural opportunities. So as you said, it doesn't seem to matter whether it's just a high school degree or an associate's or a bachelor's, or you go even farther than that. It just depends upon what your end goal is as a student, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so there's a lot of students that know they love the outdoors, they love nature, they love plants, they want to feed people, but don't always necessarily know, well, how do I do that or at what company? So they can visit the Seed Your Future website at seedyourfuture.org. We have 147 different career profiles that talk a little bit about the career, the salary information, what kind of degree do you need. There's a video that describes that career. We also have a database of scholarships because we know higher education is not free and can be a barrier. That database helps offset some of those costs. We also have a database of internships. Once you get into two or four-year college, it's good to have internships in different companies to become familiar with roles and companies. And we also have a Where to Study map that shows the 2- and 4-year horticulture programs across the country, helping students narrow down what school they might want to go to. And we also have a plant power quiz that helps students narrow down that list of 147 to a couple of horticulture jobs they might really like based on how they take the quiz. So tons of resources for those students wanting to be outside but not necessarily knowing what they can do. Our website helps them figure that out.
So final question for you. Spring Green Career Week, March 3rd to the 7th. What's special about that 1 week?
It's special because we are, again, highlighting companies, highlighting positions, and highlighting passion. People in this industry, when you ask them, why have you been here 20 years? Why have you been here 30 years? They all say the same thing. People and plants. That's what people come for in this industry, and that's what keeps them here. This next generation of young people, they want to be a part of solving problems. They want to be a part of missions, not just a 9-to-5, and horticulture is that. So being able to showcase it for these students, I'm really excited for.
We want to thank Jasmine Albarin, the Executive Director of Seed Your Future, for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Central Ohio is experiencing a nursing shortage. The problem is due to several factors, including a high demand for nurses, nursing burnout, and the continued aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic. A staggering 63% of Ohio nurses are reportedly considering leaving their current jobs due to stress and lack of assistance. One potential solution being explored is the use of AI and virtual technology for both inpatient clinical services and telehealth. CEO Michael Raymer of VitalChat joins us now on Columbus Perspective. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you today?
I am doing well. What is VitalChat?
Well, VitalChat's an innovator in the area of AI-powered ambient solutions. So for inpatient virtual nursing and procedural telehealth, very simply, we're able to put a camera and a microphone in a patient room and allow them the option of interacting with clinicians virtually rather than just pushing the nurse call button and waiting for someone to appear at their doorway. It's quick, simple, and a clinician right away can visit the patient in the room virtually.
Will VitalChat make suggestions or just disseminate information to physicians on call?
VitalChat does have an AI element to it, where we can determine if patients are about ready to fall or get out of bed. So it has warnings relative to that. Harming behavior, where they're pulling out IDs, and or beds that are sitting empty that have not been come and cleaned to enable, you know, faster turnover of hospital beds. So there's about 20 different AI triggers that we utilize, looking at the video in the room, and provide alerts to the clinical staff.
Talk to me about the nature of your company's relationship with University Hospitals in Cleveland.
They have been a key customer for VitalChat. They implemented originally in June across four of their hospital settings. And so today we're active in admission processes, monitoring patients during the hospital stay, including the ICU and the neonatal intensive care unit. And then also the products utilized to assist in accelerating the discharge process. So we have a very deep relationship with them. As CEO, I meet with their clinical team weekly to get feedback on the product and how we can better serve the needs of patients and clinicians.
One of the things that hospital systems are having to balance is budget shortfalls versus nursing shortages. Will this enable hospital systems to pay nurses a higher wage and hopefully recruit what they need?
Well, I think what our customers are finding is that the areas in the hospital in which they use virtual nursing, the nursing satisfaction level is much higher. And, you know, the other thing that is not well known is that there is an issue with violence against caregivers. So the other thing they like is that the system is able to help them, you know, protect them in the patient room and get help if needed.
Now, I don't know if you can talk about this or not, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. Are there any potential partnerships planned for Columbus or Central Ohio?
Well, we're active in market. Our first anchor customer in the state of Ohio, University Hospitals, and they've been a great partner, very innovative. But there are a number of other procurements that are ongoing in the state of Ohio right now. And, of course, our investment was led by Green Harvest Capital, which is a Cleveland-based company. And we also use another Cleveland-based company to do all of our hardware implementations across the country, and that is Resource. Very much a Ohio story, other than us being a Raleigh, North Carolina-based company.
What do you think that this technology is going to do to the future of nursing?
Well, I think it makes nurses, you know, more productive, allows them to focus their time and energy on things that are less mundane, where they can, you know, be more hands freed up to be more hands-on in the care of the patient. You know, I also think of it from a patient standpoint, and I have 92-year-old parents, and I'd very much like this technology to be in the room for them. So when they push the nurse call button, it's not a mystery as to whether anyone hears that or when they'll show up, but having that virtual nurse to be immediately available, I think is a great comfort to the patient and the families themselves. So I think this technology today, less than 5% of the hospital beds in the country have video and audio at the bedside. And most are estimating that this market over the next 4 to 5 years, it is the hottest area in digital health for investment by health systems because of the benefits both to caregivers and patients.
We want to thank CEO Michael Raymer of VitalChat for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
History was made with the swearing-in of a new lieutenant governor, former Ohio State National Championship head football coach Jim Tressel.
And the Constitution of the State of Ohio.
And the Constitution of the State of Ohio.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Tressel took the oath of office in front of a large crowd in the state capitol rotunda Friday morning. He is now Ohio's 67th lieutenant governor. Tressel replaces John Husted, whom the governor recently appointed to replace now Vice President J.D. Vance in the U.S. Senate. This all happened very quickly. It was just Monday morning when Governor DeWine nominated Tressel to be his lieutenant governor. Then, 2 days later, the Ohio House and Senate confirmed him, but not unanimously.
31 days and one day, the resolution is adopted in Utah. A resolution to confirm the appointment of the Tressel Lieutenant Governor of Ohio.
The Senate voted first Wednesday afternoon, confirming Tressel in a 31-1 vote. The House then followed shortly after with a vote of 68-27. Tressel is the former Ohio State football coach who led the Buckeyes to a national championship. He's also the retired president of Youngstown State University. When announcing Tressel as his choice for lieutenant governor, Governor DeWine said Tressel is ready to step in right away if anything were to happen to him. He also said one of Tressel's focuses would be education. Here's what lawmakers said about Tressel becoming the new lieutenant governor.
He talked to me about being deliberative, about including the voices of people that are affected by policies to the table, and I'm very hopeful that that will continue in this new role for him.
Do you have concerns that he has no government or political experience in the form of being in the legislature?
I don't, actually, because he's a professional. He's actually been in the legislature many times. He's worked with us. I've worked with him in the past on legislative matters.
He's indicated that he picked him because of his stance on education, higher education, K through 12 education, and so that's where I'm focused and had a lot of questions for him yesterday.
10TV's Dom Tiberi sat down for an exclusive interview with Governor DeWine and new Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel. They talked about the governor's decision to choose Tressel and keeping it a secret until the last minute, Tressel's focus in his new role, and whether he'll run for governor in 2 years. Here's the interview you'll see only on 10TV.
This was a big secret, and this was a big announcement. How did you keep this under wraps for, and how long did you know?
Well, not too many people knew. That's how you keep a secret, right? Don't have too many people. Fran, I, and a couple of my key people in my office knew, and that was it.
I mean, were you surprised that it didn't leak out? It was
yeah,
nothing.
Everything leaks out in this town. Everything. And so, you know, we were trying to keep it, kind of control it and make the announcement when we wanted to. And I think when we walked in, I think there was a few reporters that might have been a little surprised. Were you surprised?
I was absolutely surprised. I was shocked. Because I've known Tress for a long time, an incredible football coach. He was a college president. What makes you think that he's the perfect fit to be lieutenant governor?
You know, the most important thing is someone who could step in if I couldn't be governor. If something happened to me, I want someone who's got great judgment, who's a people person, who knows Ohio, who's a leader. Jim Tressel's all of those things. And I actually went over to his house and I called up and said, could we come over and set a time? And Fran and I went up there and We did get a view of the Buckeye Man Cave, which is, if you have not seen it, you need to go see it. But it's pretty great. But look, I just told him. I said, look, you're the person I would trust if something happened to me. And I think also with your background, particularly at Youngstown State, I've watched what he's done at Youngstown State. He's worked with the business community. He's focused on job creation, economic development, and marrying the university with businesses so kids could have jobs. All of those things are what we have to do in the state of Ohio, and we have to do it even more. So, all those reasons, I thought he was the perfect fit.
Tress, were you surprised? How surprised were you when the governor came knocking and what made you want to do this?
Well, I think he might have told me he was going to see a grandson play basketball or something. but I was surprised, But I also knew we talked a lot over the years about education and workforce. And you remember back during those COVID times when you were talking every day to everybody about how can we run this university, how can we make the state safe, how can we do the unknown. And so we had talked a lot over the years. And so when he brought up education and workforce, it's something I talked to him a lot about anyway. But yes, I was very surprised.
You were the head coach, not only Youngstown State, but the head coach at Ohio State. And I often said the two toughest jobs in America are governor and football coach, head football coach in Ohio. Do you think there's any overlap? Has that prepared you being the head coach at Ohio State for this moment?
You know, I think being a president was harder than being a coach, just because the enormity of what you're dealing with. Well, just think about being a governor, lieutenant governor. You know, your team isn't 100 guys and a dozen coaches. It's 10 million people and all these young people. And what I truly believed in about our governor is that he does want every single person in our state to reach their God-given potential, and that education's part of it and safety's part of it and workforce and opportunity and all those things. And so when you believe in something that someone else is doing and they want you to come and help, yes, it's harder, but you know, it's good work.
You are one of the most competitive people I've ever met. If you're gonna keep score, you wanna win. What is winning now, do you think?
That competitive scoreboard of how can we have less people leave our state and go work someone else, attract more people to come to our state, to be educated and to get in the workforce. And so those are the things that we'll wanna measure and then just keep having those opportunities come to the state, because everyone recognizes it's a great place with a wonderful lake and a wonderful river and a lot of natural resources and hardworking people, and they have an educated workforce.
I want him to continue to do what he's done. You know, economic development, job creation, education, you know, how all those things come together. He's really an expert in that area.
Have you been working for this moment, do you think, as you look back, all of this coming to this, you think, or is it just...
You know, it's interesting. You never know what you are going to have a chance to experience. And I remember after our Ohio State coaching days were over, my old mentor, Dr. Spurgeon, said to me, "Your greatest impact is ahead of you." And I wasn't really feeling that at that moment. He said, "If you believe it is." And so from that time on, I got new experiences, whether it was at the University of Akron or Youngstown State, or learning a little bit about what Jobs Ohio has done, and all the various times I've had a chance to sit with the governor's people. And so all of a sudden I learned about an exciting world, and now I get a chance to be a part of it.
You guys have not talked about anything other than this, Governor. You talked about, would you give him any advice, and how do you think he would do in 2 years, and where are you guys on that?
Well, we have not talked about anything other than the next 100 weeks, and you know, we didn't talk about an election or anything like that, and I think both of us want to focus on the, at this point at least, on the job at hand, and we got a lot to do. You know, I've got a clock. I showed, Fran showed Jim this clock we have, and it was given to me by Governor Bush from Florida, Jeb Bush, and he said, when I started into the last 4 years, and he said, "Here's a clock. It's a countdown clock. It literally tells you how long you have." And so every day I look at that and think, you know, hey, we better get going. We got a lot to do. And there's a real sense of urgency, and I'm just glad to have Jim as the partner to do this.
You got your eyes wide open. If you like this, is there a chance in 2 years?
We've got 698 days. We're going to stay focused.
You know, last thing, when we were in Atlanta, I asked him a question, and you, what did you say? You said, "Dom, you always called me the senator when I was coaching," right. and now you're going to be the lieutenant governor.
Well, who'd have believed it?
Also, with Tressel's coaching and athletics background, the governor says they want to do something to improve the physical fitness of Ohio's kids. They don't know yet what form that will take, but they are working to figure that out. You just saw about half of our interview with the governor and lieutenant governor. You can watch the full conversation on 10TV.com.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State. Courtesy of 10TV.
Right now, a bill that would ban DEI courses and trainings on Ohio's public college and university campuses is one step closer to becoming law. Just days ago, the Ohio Senate passed the Advance Ohio Higher Education Act. Republican lawmakers say it will ensure academic excellence on Ohio's college campuses. Opponents say it will stifle free speech and harm higher education. Senate Bill 1 ended up passing by a vote of 21 to 11, with two Republicans joining Democrats in opposition. Bill's sponsor, Senator Jerry Serino, says it will enhance diversity of thought on campuses by moving discussions more to the center and including more conservative viewpoints. The bill would prohibit universities and professors from taking positions on controversial topics. The measure would also prohibit faculty from going on strike. Opponents say the bill attacks higher education and is legislative overreach.
A lot of it is related to making sure that diversity of thought is practiced as a policy at our universities and community colleges.
It says that it's celebrating free speech at the same time that it's quashing free speech.
We spoke to the Ohio Education Association president about this bill. He tells us it has educators worried.
And so what I hear from our members in higher education is that they're really afraid. They're afraid of losing their voice, losing, their influence over what they do, their academic freedom, which is very important. And what I also hear a lot is that the message that politicians in Ohio are sending is we don't value higher education. And I've heard a lot of stories about people that are really questioning whether they might need to go to another state to teach and whether they're going to be able to recruit faculty and students to attend Ohio's colleges and universities, given these radical changes that are happening through this legislation.
I also reached out to Ohio State University. A spokesman tells me the university has not taken a position on the bill. The bill still has a long way to go. It goes to the House next, where lawmakers could make changes to it. At the same time, President Donald Trump is pushing to completely shut down the U.S. Department of Education, or at the very least, gut its funding and staff. 10TV's Kristen McFarland looks into what this could mean for the future of education here in Ohio.
The Education Department was established by Congress, meaning that it would take an act of Congress to close the department. Today, we heard from local leaders in education about their concerns should the department get cut.
The United States Department of Education allocates funding for K-12 schools. Part of this funding is for Title I program, benefiting over 800,000 students in Ohio who come from low-income families, and the IDEA program, providing fundamental resources for students with disabilities.
If we lose those services, we could see class sizes explode and a loss of thousands of educator jobs.
President of Ohio Education Association Scott DeMauro is headed to Washington, D.C. to voice his concerns to lawmakers.
How soon do you want the Department of Education to be closed?
Oh, I'd like it to be closed immediately. Look, the Department of Education's a big con job.
If the funds are eliminated, it's unclear how schools would come up with the loss of funds.
It has a direct impact on class size, has an impact on working conditions at a time when we are struggling to attract and retain good people to work in our public schools across the state.
The department also works to provide student loans and grants for higher education. Financial experts believe if these programs are eliminated or reduced, students may need to rely on private lenders to help afford college.
I think we need to be funding education, not cutting it. We want educated people, and we should do anything we can to help them.
At this moment, it's unknown if some of the department's programs will be transferred to other agencies and if they will operate at the same impact and scale. Kristen McFarland, 10TV News.
Some Democratic state lawmakers and community advocates came together to express their support for immigrants in Ohio. They say President Trump's executive orders on illegal immigration are also impacting those here legally. At a news conference, the representatives and advocates stressed a message that immigrants and refugees have a positive impact on communities, economically, artistically, and culturally. They say the president's immigration policies are causing fear, anxiety, and uncertainty for families who are here legally. Dr. Dorothy Hassan with the Central Ohio Rapid Response Network says the anxiety is real. The network makes sure immigrants know their rights, have the best information about what's going on, and have their basic needs.
Every Monday, we are delivering fresh food baskets to families who are so fearful to leave their home that they're not going to the supermarkets.
But I'm here today to tell you that immigration is our strength, not a weakness. Our country, state, and our communities have always been enriched by the contributions of immigrants and refugees.
Dr. Hassan says 2 weeks ago, the Central Ohio Rapid Response Network delivered food to 26 families. Last week, they delivered to 42 families. Governor DeWine also addressed immigration issues last week. He said Ohio is a law-following state and it will follow the law. But he repeated something he has said many times, that legal immigrants are welcome in Ohio. Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno is pushing to make English the official language in the United States. He introduced his bill in the U.S. Senate on Wednesday. Moreno's bill would make it mandatory for all official functions of the U.S. government to be conducted in English. It would also require anyone applying for U.S. citizenship to show they can read and understand English. We talked to Moreno about why he thinks this bill is necessary. He pointed to his history of coming to the U.S. from Colombia as a boy.
I came here as a kid. Had to learn the language, had to assimilate to the culture, and I think it's language and culture and history that unite us. And I think it's extremely important for us to do that. Part of the bargain, so to speak, of wanting to accept immigrants from other countries should be an acceptance that you're going to blend in with American culture and honor our traditions, honor our language, and I think it's extremely important for us to do that.
An immigration attorney tells us the current law already requires those seeking citizenship to have an understanding of English and history, with exceptions for the elderly and those with mental impairments. Moreno says if it's already the law, his bill will clarify it.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
There are many questions about how the deadly crash between American Airlines Flight 5342 and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter could have occurred. Using these sources, we're answering a few of them. First, is it common for military aircraft and commercial planes to fly near each other around Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport? Yes, there are several military bases around Reagan Airport, and the airport itself is incredibly busy, servicing more than 25 million passengers a year. The FAA has safety policies in place to prevent mid-air collisions. Data from Flight 5342's radio transponder showed the aircraft were at an altitude of around 400 feet when the crash occurred.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the Army is investigating whether the Black Hawk's altitude played a role in the crash.
Next, do commercial airplane crash alert systems operate differently below 1,000 feet? Yes, the Traffic Alert and Collision Avoidance System, known as TCAS, is a safety system that helps prevent mid-air collisions between aircraft, giving pilots visual warnings of approaching aircraft and audio messages advising how to react. But according to the FAA, below 1,000 feet, audio alerts are deactivated. Next, did the Black Hawk helicopter have a black box?
Claims online that the Black Hawk was not equipped with a black box appear to be false. On Thursday, NTSB board member J. Todd Inman said,
"We will probably have more than one black box, so to speak. It's our understanding that the Sikorsky helicopter is equipped with some form of recording devices."
And finally, people online are claiming this is the deadliest plane crash in the U.S. since 9/11. But that's not quite true. In November of 2001, a couple of months after the terrorist attack, there was a plane crash in Queens, New York that killed 260 people. With your Verify, I'm Ariane Detil.
The 14th Amendment of the Constitution says that everyone born in the U.S. is automatically an American citizen, regardless of their parents' legal status. President Trump is trying to unilaterally end that practice with an executive order issued on his first day in office. Within days, 22 different states sued to block the executive order, and a judge has already put it on hold while it's debated in court. Some critics of the order claim that it won't just impact the immigrants Trump is targeting, but also members of the president's own inner circle. They say that his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and the Second Lady, Usha Vance, would lose their citizenship because neither of their parents were citizens when they were born. Verify viewers wanted to know if the executive order could retroactively revoke citizenship. So let's verify. Our sources, the text of the order, the 14th Amendment, and the text of the court ruling. The executive order says, quote, "No department or agency of the United States government shall issue documents recognizing United States citizenship to anyone born in the U.S. if neither parent is a lawful permanent resident." But it also says that the rule, quote, "shall apply only to persons who are born within the United States after 30 days from the date of this order." The order was issued January 20th, so would only affect children born after February 19th, if it's upheld by the courts. So we can verify, no, Trump's birthright citizenship order would not retroactively revoke citizenship. Just 3 days after the order was issued, a federal judge issued a 14-day hold, calling Trump's action, quote, "blatantly unconstitutional." With your verify, I'm Casey Decker.
February is Black History Month, and today we're having a conversation with Black women about their hair. For them, every single strand, coil, and curl on their head has been the topic of discussion, and in some cases, discrimination at some point in their lives. That's why just last year, lawmakers tried to pass the Crown Act, which would have prohibited public schools from penalizing students for wearing natural hairstyles. The bill passed the House, but never made it to the Senate for a floor vote. So today, we're taking the conversation about hair directly to some local women at the center of it. In partnership with Black Girl Rising, a local nonprofit, we held a panel discussion with women of different ages and perspectives. 10TV's Rochelle Aline has the story of their beautiful roots.
First of all, thank you guys.
Womanhood is not a universal experience.
We're here to talk about our hair.
A quick poll of eight Black women across four generations about their hair makes that clear.
What was the style growing up?
When I was younger, it was like you had like four braids when your mama did them.
It wasn't dyed and layered and asymmetrical. You really wasn't.
You really wasn't cool.
Afros. Yeah. We wore afros.
Yeah. When I got into high school in the late 90s, was at sew-ins, right? Everyone wanted straight hair.
But even with all of this versatility, when it comes to hair, there are still common experiences for Black women.
Do you guys remember a defining moment, or was there a time where you recognized, like, my hair in and of itself may not be what's in or accepted?
When you go to apply for a job, You have to fit in to get in.
And I remember my first job, 4 weeks in, I'm probably three hairdos in, and my supervisor comes to me and she's a Delina. I searched for you on the Most Wanted because you change your hair so much. And I was like,
And to assimilate, many turn to a treatment to loosen or straighten their locks for years.
Can I just ask by show of hands who's had a perm here? Wow.
And can I clarify, are we talking a perm or a relaxer? Because those are two different things, right?
You're right. So I guess a relaxer. I know sometimes. Every single, I mean, most, mm-hmm. I'm the anomaly. Most Black women have had a relaxer at some point
Starting
in their life.
Eight.
And now health concerns are turning many of those women off.
2013, I decided there was no more relaxers for me. It's because my first cousins, we've all been getting relaxers since 8 and 9 years old. And all of the females that I just named all have fibroid tumors. We all do. And we're like, wait a minute. I started doing research, saw a slight association, a correlation to our relaxers. And I just asked the family as a whole, can we as a family stop doing this?
The companies, they're not looking out for us. They're looking out for the economical, They're looking for that.
What does accountability look like? What should it look like?
We as black women are an economic force. These companies are run by multimillionaires. We have power in our economic voice.
And I think it's the exposure, to your point, too, right? Making it widely known, putting the labels on there, the warning, right? Leaving it, yeah, up to the buyer, but make it known.
I think accountability starts within the community, because if we don't educate each other, how can we collectively rise up and say we don't want to support this brand?
Through this conversation, I hope it will spark other people to think about not only our conversation and what's in our products and how we do our hair, but to think about why do these black women have to have a conversation around this.
We have to talk to our children, the ones that we touch, about loving your hair the way it is.
In Columbus, Rochelle Aline, 10 TV News.
Rochelle's story was just a small portion of the one-hour discussion we held with Black Girl Rising. To see the full conversation, head to 10TV Plus, which is our free streaming service on Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.